Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Hey guys, welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig. It is 9 o'clock, which means it's time for Talk Magic. And I am here today with somebody I've spoken about on this channel an awful lot, a huge inspiration to my career. Possibly, when you think of commercial close-up magic at a very high level in the UK, this is the gentleman that you think of. He is the consummate professional and one of the best close-up magicians in the world, in my opinion. We are, of course, talking about the one and only Nick Einhorn. How are you doing, Nick?
I'm great. Thank you for that lovely introduction. But I don't believe any of it, but thank you.
It's all true, though. I mean, look at what you've achieved. I was speaking to David Penn the other day, and I was talking to him about interviewing you. And I said to David, I said, the amount, if you could take any magician and give them 10% of what you've achieved in your career, they would be over the moon. So, you know, the amount, and I think sometimes we forget how much we've achieved when it happens to us, but, you know, you've done an awful lot through your career. I'm talking like it's over. I mean, obviously it's nowhere near, but I mean, you've done...
Some would say it is.
you've done so much. So, and I know you're busy. So thank you so much for finding time to come on the channel. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
So, yeah, I mean, everyone that's going to be watching this has heard of Nick Einhorn, but just in case there's somebody watching this that lives under some sort of rock somewhere, can we talk a little bit about your backstory and kind of your career, and then we'll kind of jump off from there? Would that be okay?
Sure, absolutely.
What's your origin story, Nick? How did you kind of get into magic? It feels like you've been around at a very high level forever, but obviously that's not the case. When did you get into magic?
Yeah, I mean, I have been in magic for a long time in the magic world. But before that, obviously, you know, I got into it when I was very, very young. I was 4 years old when I had a magician at my birthday party. And one of the magicians, there were two, there were a double act. And one of the guys turned into a professional magician and later on partnered up with Paul Keeve, and they became the Zodiac Brothers. And they performed on cruise ships all over the world. And that guy was Lawrence Layton. And he became, you know, my mentor. And, you know, he's the guy that I saw when I was 4 years old. And I decided that that's what I want to do. I want to be a magician. So that was the kind of initial spark, if you like. And then my dad went to Hamley's. I'm not sure who was in there at the time. Could have been Ali Bongo at the time that was selling magic. But all I know is he picked up a, you know, Vanishing Silk in Thumbtip. It was the last one remaining, and I realize as I'm saying this, it obviously wasn't the last one remaining. There were another 25 underneath the counter, and he told my dad it was the last one remaining. He fell for it. I can't believe it. didn't even think about that after all these years. And someone was umming and ahhing, and my dad said, I'll have that. And he took it, came home and showed me, and I was like, wow, that's incredible. And then, you know, I learned that. I've still got that very thumb tip, actually.
And how old were you at that point?
I was probably about 5 or 6 years old. I mean, it's really young.
That's a really kind of advanced trick for a 5 and 6 year old, isn't it? To be able to do the vanishing silk. That's great.
Yeah, but that was the first thing that I kind of ever performed. And then I had a magic set given to me by my auntie. And I just got hugely into it, really. And it progressed from there. I had a magician who taught me a little bit every other week or so. I used to go to him for lessons, and he used to teach me, and I learned a lot from him. Then I joined the Ilford Magic Society later on when I was old enough, joining the Magic Circle.
Wow. And was there a young Magic Circle when you were, no, because that's only a recent thing. So you didn't get a chance to go into a young version of the Magic Circle. You went straight into the Magic Circle when you were 18.
Yeah, I wrote to Equity. I wanted to belong to Equity, and I didn't have any contracts at the time. It was very difficult to become a member of Equity. I wrote to the Magic Circle. They said you had to be 18, but join your local Magic Society. So I did. I joined Ilford Magic Society, And they looked after me. I mean, I learned a lot from a lot of their members. I'm still very good friends with a lot of them there. And, you know, people like Kevin Bird, who I spent a lot of my youth growing up with. And, you know, we used to be good mates. Scott Penrose, all of these people I used to see every other week at the Ilford Magic Society. So I got to know them very well. And then the Magic Circle, I performed at the Magic Circle many times, even though I was younger, because there was a man called Alf Gabriel, who used to do an annual show called Alf Gabriel and Friends. And he was an old boy there who was loved. I think he was a drummer by trade. And he was, you know, this magician that used to put on this annual event. So I did that for him. John Gordon had something called Not the Magic Circle. And that was an event that I performed at many times. So I was kind of familiar to some of the members. And then my 18th birthday, I got a surprise from my parents that arranged for me to be proposed and seconded. I believe I was proposed or seconded. I'm going to get this. I'm pretty certain it could have been Scott Penrose and David Berglas that proposed and seconded me.
That's not a bad couple of people to vouch for you, is it?
No, I know. I don't know that for sure, but I'm pretty certain in the back of my head that's what it was. And so when I was 18, I kind of, they'd seen me perform and I didn't realise one of my performances, they were marking me and they based that on the fact that I should be a member. So I became a member when I was 18.
So we've talked about how you got into magic and we've talked about you joining the Magic Circle. You must have been performing at a very young age as well, because I speak to so many people when I interview them and they go, oh yeah, it was just a hobby, but I never actually went out and did a gig. But you're saying before you were even 18, you were performing in front of the members of the Magic Circle, which is a nerve-wracking thing to anybody, let alone a kid who's, wow, that's incredible that, you know, you got...
Yeah, I mean... I was doing kids shows by the time I was 14. My parents would drive me around to events at the weekend. And then, you know, I did perform at several magic conventions, or not conventions, but magic meetings. I remember doing shows with Pat Page and Alan Shaxson. You know, I was never a member of the Magic Circle at that time. So I must have been 16 or 17. I think my parents drove me there. And I remember Alan Shaxson specifically being very, very friendly, warm towards me. He's one of my mentors, huge inspiration to me, and actually I always modeled myself on being that kind of person when I was, you know, performing. Someone that I really respected and still do, you know, obviously, but I miss him greatly. Fantastic magician.
Absolutely, 100%. So when you joined the Magic Circle at 18, Did you go on to further education, or was it in your head, I just want to be a professional magician? Or did you was there a time where you had a job, or did you go to university? Was there a backup plan, or was it always I want to do this, I love this, this is what I want to do for a living?
I always wanted to do it. I knew I was going to be a professional magician if I could make it happen. I left school, I went to university, but I probably went to study the wrong thing. I should have done graphic design, because I was very good at it. And I ended up in doing a dance, music and drama degree. But I couldn't dance, I couldn't sing, and I couldn't act. So after about 3 months of that, I left. In fact, I begged Marvin Berglas for a job. I said, you have to. I've been doing magic for Marvin's Magic in Hamleys and Harrods, which is nice, because that's where I got my first magic trick from. So it all kind of went full circle. And I remember phoning him and saying, I need to leave. It was in November. And I said, I need to leave university. I need to go home and get myself a job, because I need to earn some money. You've got to give me a job, please, please, please. Because I did my work experience with Marvin and then subsequently worked for him loads after that and learned a lot doing the Marvin's Magic stuff. And met some wonderful people there, which, you know, we can talk about more later. And then he gave me a concession in Lakeside Shopping Centre, which was one of the very few outside of London they had around the country. And I literally walked in one day that there wasn't even a counter for the stock. I had to kind of drag a counter across from one department to the other in Debenhams, I think it was, and set up this counter full of magic. And I created this little magic shop within Debenhams, and I think it was Debenhams, and then basically outside of London, it was the top selling magic shop for Marvin's Magic. So I did a good job for him, and then carried on working there. I went to work for an advertising agency for a while. I wanted to get into advertising, but I wasn't on the creative side, and I really wanted to do that. So I worked there for about 7 or 8 months, and then I left there because didn't really want to do it anymore. And then I went to work. I was just about to start doing magic full time. And then I did a trade show, and Carter Mundi, the playing card company, were there. They saw me doing some stuff for a juggling company, trying to sell juggling balls. I don't juggle, but I was doing magic. And they said to me, they wanted to talk to me. And they said to me, look, we want to try and sell to Kellogg's, putting magic tricks. This is when you're allowed to have things in the cereal packets. And they wanted to do a series of card tricks that each had about 5 or 6 cards in a pack, and they would be dropped into the cereal packet so that kids could learn magic over breakfast, you know, and you'd get like a free magic trick. So I came up with a series of things that we went to Kellogg's or Nestle with, and we kind of pitched this idea, and it never really happened. But then they said, well, we want you to come and work for the company and help us sell playing cards. So I went to work for them for about 6 months.
Wow.
And yeah, so that was interesting, but I was never really doing that kind of stuff. It was me picking up the phone and saying, how many promotional decks of cards do you want to order? Mm-hmm. We'll get that sorted for you. And that's not what I wanted to do. So I then left there, and that's when I really did the magic, you know, full time, from probably about the age of 20, 21.
A couple of things I want to pick up on there. And the first thing I want to pick up on is I interviewed Marvin, and he talked about how important it is when you're first getting into magic to try and do something like demonstrating magic, because it teaches you the skill of approaching people. And it's not just about the tricks, but it's about being personable and getting on people's wavelengths. Would you say that experience of demonstrating magic and Marvin's kind of helped you as a performer?
Yeah, definitely developed me as a performer. And I think the key facts here are that it's irrelevant that you're selling a product, you're actually selling yourself. So first and foremost, what you want to do is you want to build a rapport with people. When it comes to sales, you want to build a rapport. You want to intrigue them and interest them in the product. You want to show the benefits of the product, and you want to close the sale. And all of these things are really important, not just to selling magic tricks, but actually when it came to later on selling myself for many of the residences that I then started to pick up, I was learning the key tools about how to close a sale. And I did my dad was an insurance salesman, and he belonged to something called the Million Dollar Round Table. And he used to go to these big conferences in New York, and they used to come back with listening to these fantastic motivational speakers. And they had all of them were caught on cassettes. And I used to listen to them as a kid and be motivated by people. By what they were saying and how they were closing sales and all of their encouraging stories and motivational stories. And so, yes, absolutely. Marvin's Magic enabled me to A, stand on my feet for 7 or 8 hours a day, B, make every performance fresh, like it's the first time you've ever performed it, C, build a crowd, D, give them some kind of desire that they wanted the product, and then give them the belief that they could actually do it. And Marvin's Magic is a great range of magic, and was even back then. The quality was very, very good, better than anything else you could get of the same types of magic sets that were out there. Mm-hmm. were cheap and nasty, and by not all of them, but most of them. I mean, Tenyo stuff was obviously brilliant, but Marvin's Magic was on par with Tenyo in terms of quality, and I think it was, you know, it's a very decent set. It felt like you were selling quality, and I enjoyed my time. And while I was there, I was mixing with people like Mark Paul and Anthony Owen, Paul Andrews, Stephen Mulhern, John Allen. There were so many people, Andy Nyman, that we were all part of the same group. So these people I grew up with, they were like my best friends at the time, and feel very honored to have been with them all.
That's fantastic. That really is. So you then went full-time pro. And you mentioned residences there. So when you first started, obviously, there's always that nervous thing, isn't there? Well, now I'm standing on my own two feet. I don't have another wage or another thing. I haven't got a backup plan. This is it. Was your approach to go down the residency route? Because obviously now we know you as top corporate magician, and that's kind of the arena in which you perform. But was that the case when you first, obviously it wasn't probably the case when you first started. Was it the residency route that you went down?
Yeah, it was. And even while I was still at school, about 18 years old, I went to my local harvester. I'd gone to see Michael Amar do a lecture. I'm a big fan of Michael Amar. Always have been. Love everything he stands for. Love everything he performs and how he performs it, how he engages people. Just really love his magic. And then I bought his book, The Magic of Michael Amar. And in there is a huge kind of chapter about selling yourself with magic and about psychology of that kind of stuff. And I put together this concept, this idea of going to sell myself at restaurants. And I'd gone to my local harvester and I managed to get the gig. It's horrible to think about now, but on a Sunday afternoon, I would be standing there in like a tuxedo and a bow tie, you know, a harvester, performing to people that were walking through the door in their ripped jeans and their t-shirts. So, you know, it was just so, I mean, now I think about it, it's ridiculous. But that kickstarted a whole load of residences that I then picked up. I didn't just pick them up. I mean, I went out of my way to get them. But at one time I was doing about 3 or 4 residences a week. And I remember, you know, some of them were pretty damn good as well. I mean, one of them I still do to this day, and has grown into a whole other business, which is huge. And we can talk about that if you want to later. But I still have clients that I speak to and that use me and book me. In fact, I'm doing one on Thursday for a guy that I met through one of my residencies 22 years ago. Wow. And they're still using me. Yeah, every year they've used me.
That's great.
So those residences are unbelievable, you know, and several of my clients are still using me that far on. And, you know, every now and then on 20 year anniversary, I'd send them a big gift saying thank you for 20 years of business and that kind of thing. And it's rare. I mean, it's rare to have that kind of relationship with people, but that's what I've done over. I mean, I've been performing, when I think about it, for like 25 years full time. It's a long time to be in the business. Yeah. And I pride myself on staying in touch with clients, or the amount of clients that return and want to book me again and again and again.
That's I mean, that's great. I mean, obviously, I suppose the advice here is you've got to get the right type of residences if you want that. Like, you have a residency in a grotty little pub, you're probably not going to be picking up repeat clients compared to if you're at kind of a high-end restaurant or something like that.
Yeah.
Have you got any advice very quickly on getting residences? Because that is a question that comes up on this channel a lot. I want to get myself a restaurant residency. People love it because it's regular income, it builds up a client base. And also, if you're new into magic, it's that flight time, isn't it? It's going out and performing to real people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the rules, if I were going to do it now, the rules that I used back then would probably still stand, even though they seem a little old fashioned. First of all, I think you need to go, you can't just walk into a venue and say, I want to speak to the manager, I've got an idea for you. I set up a meeting. I said, I intrigued them, first of all, because I didn't tell them why or what it was about. But I said, I've got an idea for you that I think would help you with what you're doing within your restaurant. And I'd like 10 minutes of your time to come and meet you and discuss it with you. And if you don't like it, you'll never see me again. This was one of the lines I used to use, which is, if you don't like the idea, you'll never see me again. If you like it, you know, we can chat. It's not going to cost you anything. It's, you know, I really genuinely think I've got something of value for you. I'd then set up a time. I'd go and meet them. I'd have a few bits in my pocket. Of course I would, to, you know, if they wanted to see something. And I spoke to them about not me so much, but the benefits to the restaurant. So when the restaurant's really busy, they're getting stressed in the kitchen and they're going to be maybe 10 minutes longer getting the food to their table than they need to. It's not a problem. I can entertain those people for 10 minutes. They won't even realize they've been waiting. So when you've got a client that you know is going to be waiting, or a customer that you know is going to be waiting, you give me a nudge and say, can you go and entertain them? You know, table number 6, they're going to be waiting for a while. You've got regular people that come back again and again. And if you're you know, certainly in today's world with social media, if you can blast out on your social media that you're going to be here on this date or whatever, you can actually help bring in customers for the restaurant and build up a following and stuff like that. So it's very much about finding out what the benefits to them are going to be. The other thing that I used to do, and again, things might have changed now, but I used to get paid for doing the residency. And I think the people that were working in the restaurants as, you know, serving and waiting, they probably either knew what I was being paid or they felt like I was being paid a lot more than them for being in there for 2 hours. And they were in there for like a 6 or 7 hour shift. So every time I got a tip, I would actually give it to the waiters and waitresses. I would put it in their tip jar. And they loved me for it. So they would say, oh, you've got to see our magician. He's fantastic. And they would then get everyone excited. I'd go over there and perform. And if I got a tip, I'd put it in their tip jar. And that endeared me to the people that I was working with. And that's what I always did. I did that for a long time. I mean, it doesn't always happen now. It's kind of a weird thing now. It doesn't really go anywhere, the tips. But there used to be a central tip jar that all the tips used to go in. And they used to kind of really love that. So I was being paid enough that I didn't have to worry about taking an extra £3 or whatever it was, but they loved it.
That's great. That's absolutely fantastic. Yeah. That's really good advice. So off the back of the residences, did you then push forward with more corporate work and kind of transition into where we kind of see you performing now? And I suppose the other question is, we've talked up until this point primarily about close-up magic, but I know that you do a lot of stand-up shows, and when did that come about? I mean, was that something that you did when you were performing at the Magic Circle that you then, yeah. So how did that come about? Because obviously restaurants are close up, but I know you do a lot of stand-up stuff now. So,
yeah, I've always done stand-up. I mean, that's something that is perhaps a little unusual. I always loved close-up magic, but I grew up in an era where I was, you know, influenced by Alan Shaxon. Well, Alan Shaxon, although he did close-up magic, and I worked with him on many events doing close-up, he primarily was a cabaret performer. Yeah. And so, you know, people like him were my inspiration. So I knew that I needed to learn a stand-up act. And so when I talked earlier about doing shows with Pat Page and Alan Shaxon, I was doing my stand-up, you know, stage thing. I would have a 10 or 15 minute act that I used to perform even when I was 16 or 17. And that was just, I never even thought about it. It was just what I did. My head teacher booked me for his, he was part of a lodge and he had a dinner and he brought me into his office once. And I thought I was gonna get the cane. And he said to me, what are you doing on Saturday night? I wanna book you for a gig. And I ended up working for my headmaster, which was bizarre. But I did this stand-up show, you know, and I used to do some, when I think about it, I used to have a fairly decent, you know, fun act. So yes, I've always performed stand-up. I probably at the moment, especially as we come out of lockdown, which is where we are at the timing of this recording, I'm doing more stand-up than close-up. And I have, it's been a kind of fine balance between the two for a long time, but I absolutely prefer standing on stage and performing to a big audience or even a small audience than I do from doing the close-up now. I mean, I love close-up magic and always will, but there's nothing quite like the thrill of standing on stage. And I've always been very comfortable with that. And yeah, done that forever. And as I say, do more of that now than anything else.
So any advice that you can give people? Because this is the number one question that comes up on this channel, which is, I'm a close-up magician. I want to transition to doing stand-up shows. How do I do that? Because there is a world of difference between going up to four people at an event in a group and walking out cold on stage in front of a couple of hundred people, not just purely from the trick selection and the attitude and the way you carry yourself and what you have to prepare beforehand and so on and so forth, but also from a nerves point of view. You know, it's a lot more nerve-wracking going out on stage cold in front of an audience and, you know, winning them over than it is going up to a group and interjecting yourself for a few minutes.
Yeah, I think that comes with, you know, flight time, as you mentioned before. The more you do it, the less nervy you're going to be. You've got to rehearse. It's got to be structured. It's got to be scripted. Even if you go off a little bit with your script, you've got to know what you're saying. You can't come on and not really know what's next. I mean, I work with a quite a well-known person, I won't mention who it was, And I was quite surprised. They had this box full of tricks, if you like, props next to them. And they didn't actually know what they were going to be doing next. They just looked in and had a little route around and picked something up and performed it. That, for me, is an absolute no-no. Like, when I go to an event, I know exactly what I'm going to be performing. And that means that it doesn't always mean that my show's the same, because every time I get a gig, I look at the number of people, I look at the venue, the type of performing space, and I make a judgment about what's going to be right for that audience in terms of how long I've got, the angles, the venue, the age group, and all of that kind of stuff. So I probably spend as long thinking about what I'm going to perform as actually doing the performance itself, which is, you know, mad. You kind of think you just pick up your bag and go, but that never happens for me, at least. You know, I like to give it a lot of thought. So if you're going to transition between doing close-up and doing stand-up, you've got to think bigger. It's got to work to a bigger audience. And you've got to be very aware when you're performing of how you are looking at the audience, how you're engaging the audience. You've got to own the stage. And that doesn't mean being cocky. It means being comfortable. If I've had a number of occasions where I've brought someone up to the stage and they've given me hassle for one reason or another, or I realized that they were drunk or they're just not the right person. And now, ordinarily, if I wasn't performing, I'd find that quite an intimidating situation and I wouldn't really know how to handle it effectively. But on stage, it's like a switch has been flicked. I know exactly what to do instinctively. I know how I can get them back to their seat, get someone else up, maybe get a laugh along the way. And just look like I'm in charge of the show, because the last thing you want is for them to kind of suddenly change the way that the audience view you because you look like you're an amateur and you don't really know what you're doing. So it's all about being in control. The moment you walk on stage, they have to feel like you own it. And I've spent a long time trying to hone those skills. Again, it's a very fine line between being cocky and coming across as someone that, you know, is not very engaging. And coming on full of confidence, but being likable and being effective with, you know, whatever you're performing and whatever you're saying.
That's,
if that makes any sense.
Brilliant advice. I hope everybody listened to every word of that. That's amazing. And so true. I want to ask you a couple of specific things, because obviously we've got to a point where your career's taken off. I'm not going to say dominate, that sounds terrible, but you are at the very top of your game. You know, you're not going to have to worry about getting your next gig. You're brilliant. So here's a question, a couple of questions for you. Number one, what made you decide to do Penn and Teller Fool Us? Because and now, with 8 years of experience of Penn and Teller, we know what it's like. We know the format. It's not really so much of a risk for people that are going into season 9. But you're on season 1, and Penn and Teller have a reputation of screwing with magicians and messing up their tricks. And then suddenly it's like, hey, we're going to do this show where we're going to get magicians and we're going to try and guess how their tricks work. As somebody who's at a very high level and has clients, did you kind of think, well, this is kind of going to be a bit of a risk? Or did you do, because your performance, obviously you fooled them. It was incredible. I have no idea how it worked. It was engaging. And that's the thing. Sometimes you see people go on Penn and Teller and they fool them with something that's very boring. You were entertaining and engaging. It was a great showcase for you, but you also fooled them. So I suppose the question is, what made you decide to go down that route? And did you have in the back of the mind, this could be a risk, because season 1, you didn't really know what it was all about.
Yeah, you're quite right. Penn and Teller was a complete, Fool Us was a complete unknown quantity at the time. I had a phone call from Paul Stone, who was over in Las Vegas and working alongside the production company. And he was looking for acts to do this. He knew they were going to be filming it in the UK. And so he was obviously trying to look for UK based magicians for the pilot originally. And he asked me to be part of it and said, we really want you on the show. This is what you have to do. Come up with something that's going to fool them, blah, 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 blah. I couldn't think of anything. And I was worried and I was concerned. And so I just kind of let it go. And they did the pilot, which was the one that Bernal and John Archer did so well on. And, you know, that was the original one. And then once they'd been flown out to Vegas and they had the whole kind of thing. And once I'd seen it, I knew that the production was really smart. It was really nicely done, that they weren't trying to make magicians look stupid. They actually seemed to be like really nice guys. So when they phoned and said, look, we're now going to series, we want you on series one. I was interested, but I didn't have anything that I thought would fall them. So I said, I need to give it some thought. And I thought about it for a long, long time. And then I came up with some really crazy ideas. One of them bizarrely at the time, was that my cousin married someone that is cousins with Jonathan Ross's wife. And Jonathan Ross was at the time the presenter of it. So at the time, I was going to see if she could get hold of one of Jonathan Ross's watches without him realizing and do something with his watch where it ended up, you know, like how teleport it from his house to the studio or do something crazy. And he would have no idea. Anyway, some ridiculous thing. But that thought came and went. But I thought of all these crazy, crazy things that I could do. And I had no idea. And then I was on holiday with my family and then woke up in the middle of the night with this idea based on something that I've been playing with, but making it much bigger for stage use and doing it, you know, in a TV studio. And that was the key thing. On TV, it's got to fill the studio and look interesting. And so to give the whole trick or effect some kind of theme of being in a restaurant and doing things with menus seemed to, in my mind, to be a good idea. And usually the first person I would call at the time, very, very friendly with Nigel Mead. He's one of my best friends and fantastic magician. And we talk to each other endlessly each week, even now, about ideas, and we share ideas and go backwards and forwards and stuff. And I called him while I was on holiday and I said, what do you think of this? And we talked about it for about 45 minutes. And then that was the seed in my head. And then I went back and said, you know what, I've got something I think might fool you. I'll do it. And that was really it.
It went brilliantly.
It did. And actually in the rehearsal, I met Johnny Thompson for the first time in some rehearsal room, and he loved the trick. And then you had to kind of disclose how it worked, or not openly, but you had to write it down and kind of give it to them so that they had that, so that if there was any contention, they could have a look and check. And I remember him being very complimentary about the performance and about the trick and the effect and the way that it was presented. He was a lovely, lovely man.
Is it a routine? I mean, it was such a wonderful routine. Is it one that you've been able to replicate in your stand-up performances? Or, I mean, it takes up such a lot of stage and there's so much to it. Or is it really just kind of a one-off thing for Penn and Teller and then it was retired?
As that looks, you know, that whole thing with the three tables and everything like that. No, I've never replicated that at all in that format. I put that together. That's the only time I've ever performed it in that kind of way. Having said that, I have performed slightly different versions over the years, using the same principle and it's essentially the same effect, but just changing the props, if you like. I did something for the... it was actually in Qatar for the tennis championships. And they had a gala dinner for Nadal and Federer were the guests of honor. And I remember this because they said there were going to be 50 people at this dinner. And I was very excited. And I flew over with my act all the way to Doha. And it was at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. And I walked in and it was actually laid out for 500 people. And I had a bit of a shock because there's a bit of a difference between the two. But the trick, the way that I kind of themed it was about the importance of making decisions. And when you're playing tennis and that ball comes towards you, your brain makes dozens of decisions in the space of a split second. Are you going to play a forehand, a backhand? Are you going to spin it? Is it going to be topspin? Are you going to lob it? Are you going to try and place it near the net at the back of the court? There's so many different thoughts that go through your mind, and decision making is everything to do with this routine. So I thought it fitted quite nicely. And then all of the products that I used and all of the props that I used were relevant to tennis and the fact that there was Nadal and Federer there and stuff like that. So that was, kind of a little twist on it. So I have used it since, but in slightly different guises.
That's fantastic. That's really cool. And that kind of brings me on to my next question, which is creativity. I mean, because that's a very creative way. You've taken it. You first of all, you created the whole thing for Penn & Teller, and then you adapted it for a particular situation there, which I know is something you do all the time.
Yeah, and I didn't invent that trick, by the way. That was based on the work of other magicians, you know. So it's all published, but I basically took an idea and then changed it and moved it to something different. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you've created so much magic over the years, and that's the other aspect of you, of Nick Einhorn. It's not just the performer that we've been talking about up until this point, but you're known as an incredible lecturer, creator, innovator, some amazing. I mean, I remember when I first got into magic, your haunted pack, everyone did that. Like every single close-up magician that I know did that routine. And I remember buying, for my illusion show, one of the first big illusions I ever bought was your levitation.
In flight,
which was in my show for many, many years. You've brought out so many different tricks. A lot of people think of close-up stuff that you've brought out, but you brought out so many other things. What made, and it's always quality, and I think that's important to note. You see a lot of magicians that bring out trick, and there's a variation in quality. That's not the case with you. So what made you decide to go down the creativity and the releasing product route? Because let's be honest, you didn't need to. It's not like you're thinking, well, I need to pay the mortgage this month, I better go and release a trick. But so what was your desire to actually start lecturing and creating magic?
I think early on, it was the fact that I might have come up with an idea. Now, there was a couple of things very early on in my career. You might be familiar with, when David Blaine was on TV and he bit a coin and then spat it back out and it came back onto the coin. That was very popular and being sold, the bitten coin thing that was, you know, very popular. And I actually thought to myself, it makes far more sense to do that with a cookie. So I bought a rubber cookie and found a way to do a very similar thing where it looks like you're biting the cookie and you spit it back on. And so I sold that as a trick called Crumbs. And it sold pretty well. They were all handmade by me. And you know, it was very simply put together, but it worked fine. And then later on, somebody came out with pretty much the same thing with an Oreo cookie. But I'd done it years before that. There was another thing with a pen where you imagine a pen where you pull out a banner, and on that banner I had printed lots of cards, and it was a trick called Penultimate.
I showed it on the channel the other week and everyone was like,
no,
where can you get this? I'm like, you can't get it anymore. It's amazing.
No,
it's a trick.
That's so funny. So I did, you know, so I came up with these ideas, and of course I couldn't just have one made, because you needed to, you know, those pens you can only buy 500 or 1,000 at a time. But I did like the design I mentioned before about, you know, graphic design. So I thought, well, let's do it as a little project. Let's design the artwork for the instructions. I'll go to a local printer and get it printed. And then I'll have the product made and I'll design all of that stuff. So I used to love collating everything and putting it together. And in the early days of selling Spooked, I mean, we're going back to 1995, maybe 1995 or 96, you know, I was selling Spooked, and I was putting adverts in Abra, Genie, Magic magazine at the time, maybe, don't even know if that existed, but it was definitely Genie magazine, and suddenly I'd be getting postal orders through, you know, the door, and I was a great thrill, you know, used to get checks through every 2 seconds. There weren't bank transfers back then, everything was a physical check, and I'd come home and I'd have like 10 or 15 checks lying on my floor, and I'd sit there and package them up, and I used to love, I get a huge buzz out of doing that, and it was all supplementary to all of the performing work that I was doing. And these were tricks that I was actually using, you know. I did use those in my work. In fact, Spooked is still my number one go-to effect. If someone says, here's some really important people, go and perform for them, that's the one trick that I would perform where I know I could do that and just walk away. And they just, you can't do anything else after that.
Yeah, it's incredible.
You know, for me, it's still the best thing that I do. But no longer available at the moment.
I had to say, Spooked is no longer available. And also, I really wish you'd bring Penultimate back, because genuinely, it's so commercial. It's just a pen in your top pocket. Boom. Like, it's you're perfect anytime, anywhere. Carry it anywhere trick.
Thank you. I think some other people have bought out stuff that's similar. And I don't know how much. I'm not convinced it would be a huge seller, but I'm glad you liked it though.
I'm
not even sure I've still got one here, so you're doing well.
Yeah, I've still got it. And then obviously, you know, you bought all these tricks out, and it's always great quality. And there's always a variety. I mean, recently I saw the dice thing. You had the dice with the matrix.
Elevated dice matrix, yeah.
Which fooled the hell out of me when I saw that. I was like, how did that work? That's another example of just really creative thinking. But then obviously off the back of that, you and Craig Squires bought out Digital Force Bag. And I talked about this off camera. This has become it. I think it is the number one app. Like, I've done lots of shows on this channel about apps, and I review all of them. I think it's most people, even people that don't like app magic, they like Digital Force Bag because it doesn't feel like app magic. And I don't think I've seen so one app being used on television in so many different ways at all. It's incredible. So it is the go-to method to force things now for most magicians.
It is amazing how many people are using it, and I have a compilation I put together of the panel of Britain's Got Talent, and it's quite funny because when you cut it together they're going 33 21 46 24 and you just see the same thing, same process every time. But it's very, very practical, and DFB is one of those apps which it only does one thing, but it does it incredibly well and effectively and efficiently. You don't need internet access. It's just ready to go anytime. You can personalize it for whatever you want to do. There's a way that you can perform it and make it absolutely yours. In fact, obviously, you know, I was the first to use it because, you know, we developed it. But I even in the last 2 or 3 months, I've started using it in a way that I've never used it before for a stand-up show. And it's now become one of the things in my stand-up show that I know is going to get that massive gasp because it's structured in such a way that it's part of a much bigger piece and it really works theatrically. So I'm really excited to use it when I do my stand-up shows. But it's ready to go at a moment's notice, and you can make it as convoluted or as simple as you like.
Well, honestly, I think using it stand-up, it's more organic, really, to an audience than bringing out a see-through bag with a whole bunch of stuff in it. Like, I've got this see-through bag that looks like nothing you've ever seen before, or I've got this phone that's got a notes page on it. Everybody can relate to that. So,
here's a tip. You know, you don't. I when I do it in my show, I don't talk about it as being in my notes. In fact, what I say is there was a list that was published in the newspaper a few weeks ago. Some of you may have seen it. And I talk about this list and what it was and what the list contained. And I say, I've got a copy of it on my phone. I want you to think of a number. And then I go to that one person and I say, you can see the list. Well, I never mention notes. As far as anyone is concerned, just by the way that I've phrased it, it's a picture of a list that was in a newspaper. So they don't even know that it's anything more than a photograph.
That's great. And this whole dual reality, that dual reality moment just sells it even more. That's great. Yes. And one question. You obviously now offer this for Android and Apple. And anyone who doesn't know what this is, you really need to get it. It's incredible. For a while, you didn't really offer Android support. And now you do. I get asked the question a lot on this channel. Why do so many app developers not develop for Android? Why is it that why do Apple users get all the good apps? And
it's very simple to answer that. Very simple.
What to know?
There's two main reasons. Number one, Androids take on all shapes and sizes and models and makes. And so for you to make one thing that works on every single shape and of screen and every configuration of Android user, that might, that what they might have and their own setups, it's incredibly huge, the amount of different variations. So just to, you know, just to do a bit of artwork that fits every single Android screen is an effort in itself. Whereas Apple will only have a finite amount of different sizes that's within its parameters. But Android depends whether you're using this phone or this model or that version. There's a million different versions. But the most important thing is the security element, which is that to have an app made costs many thousands of pounds, and people think that it's quick, they think it's cheap. It's neither of those things, because it's a huge investment in time and money to have something built. And it's also progressive. It starts off, you've got the idea, and then you have to tweak it, and you have to keep moving it and changing it, and different versions. I mean, we must have gone through, when we made the new version, about 15 different versions of the same thing. And there's still things that need to be tweaked a little bit, but there's no point in every 2 seconds making a change, because you have to kind of work out what needs changing. And if you're going to make certain changes, it has a knock-on effect to some other bit of the app down the line. But the most important thing is that Android wasn't secure enough and basically got stolen, ripped off and sold online by people that do this stuff. They rip people off, they sell it cheap. And it was done within days of the original app coming out. And it costs us thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds. And there's no reason for us to then feel like we need to upgrade or service something which is just being ripped off, because there's no protection from Android or Google. So we had to think very carefully about whether we were going to make the new DFB Pro available for Android users. And we've done so, and hopefully done it in a more secure way, and done it in a way which has worked, you know, pretty well for most, if not all, Android users. So now they have a very similar experience, if not the same, to DFB on iPhone.
And it just shows the support that the app has and how much you believe in it, because very few app developers go down the route of offering something for Android. So it just shows that you've listened to your customers, and that's, you know, that's fantastic.
I will say, though, all the Android users, when before the Android version came out originally, it was just on iPhone, and every Android user would say, but there's just as many Android users as iPhone users, and you're missing out on a huge market. Well, yes, there's certainly a big market for Android users, but in my experience, there's still a lot more people using iPhones, magicians using iPhones, than magicians using Android phones. So that's just my opinion. But I think that, you know, in my experience has shown that's the case. But Craig Squires, you know, he's my business partner, both doing some of the products that I've released or we've released, but also we have other business together, which we work on. And he's fantastic, you know.
I wanted to bring that up. I mean, you mentioned that you have another business, and I knew that. I don't really know what it is, but I remember pre-COVID, I was working at Tottenham Hotspur, I felt really bad when I got there, because the client had booked me directly. They booked me like years for all of their events, and I turned up, and Craig Squires was there, and he said, "Oh yeah, me and Nick do this." And I'm like, I felt really bad. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm not trying to tread on your toes. And he was lovely, and he's like, no, it's absolutely fine. You got booked by the clients. But he said then that what this business that you do with Craig is, it? I don't think it's magic related, is it? Can you talk?
No, I've been one of the residences I started 25 years ago. Was Tottenham Hotspur Football Club. So I walked, I wrote to them. I managed to get a meeting with them. I got my foot in the door. I started performing there on a match day. And for every single home game for the last 25 years, without exception, other than COVID closing the stadium, I have been working at every single home game for the last 25 years in their hospitality lounges. And that has grown. So before we moved to the new stadium, which was about 3 years ago now, I would perform every single match day. And at one point we had 2, 3, or even 4 other magicians working in all of the corporate hospitality lounges in the old ground. Now about 6 or 7 years ago, I became aware that Tottenham were going to build a £1 billion stadium on the site of the original Stadium. And I knew that there was going to be this huge new venue, which wasn't just going to be football. It was going to be unlike any other venue at the time that was ever built. A major entertainment venue for concerts, sporting events and everything else. And I had this concept, this idea that I would go to them and try and bring in all the entertainment that happens in the stadium. And because of my association and because of the people that I knew there, I knew exactly who was working on this project. And I sat down for lunch at one of the matches, chatting with them as I did every match. And I just dropped this into conversation that I would like to come and have a chat with them. And they kind of said, well, probably not. You know, you do great magic and the magicians are great, but you're probably not. We're talking about a £1 billion stadium. Probably not going to be talking to you, Nick, with respect about bringing entertainment into the stadium. I said, well, you know, over the years, I've worked with some of the best acts in the world. And I feel that I've got quite a lot that I could bring to the table. And would you at least give me a chance to tell you a little bit more about my thoughts? And so he said, yeah, when the time comes, I'll give you the opportunity to come and do a little pitch. And he kind of brushed it off to some extent. But as time moved on and things started to develop and they started to build the new stadium, I felt the time was right to ask for that meeting. Now, at the time, I had this concept of it just being me bringing in entertainment, whether that was music or magic or whatever. And Craig is a partner that I've worked with for years. He's got his own events, very successful events company. And so I had a chat with him about it. And he said, yeah, this sounds like an interesting project. But when we discussed it, he said, this is bigger than just the two of us. There's somebody else that we both knew that he'd worked with a lot, as a lady called Katrina, who also had a fabulous company that she still runs, and it's incredibly successful. And he said, I think we need a third person if we're going to make this work, because it's going to be bigger than all of us. And so we ended up getting this pitch, and I spent two months writing this pitch, refining it, introducing both Katrina and Craig, explaining why they were partners, why I'm bringing them on as partners, and why together we were going to be able to provide something amazing. You know, and I was once taught that you've got to know what you know, you've got to know what you don't know, and then you've got to know the people that know the things that you don't know. And that was my opening line for this pitch. It was that these are the people that know the things that I don't know, but together we know everything about what we're doing, and we can provide you with everything you need. And to wrap it all up. And so we did this really interesting pitch, which was very, very different at the time to anything that I think they would have seen. They could see the amount of effort and expense that we put into doing it. And then along the way, Katrina had happened to mention that she also provides hostesses and hosts for Silverstone Grand Prix and for some very large events. And they said to us, oh, tell us more, because we're interested in that side of things as well. So she explained a little bit more. And so now our business really takes place. This is more than you ever wanted to hear. I know.
I'm fascinated about the entrepreneurial side of magic and you know, getting beyond magic and the business sides. This is absolutely fascinating to me, and I think
what started as me doing card tricks has now grown to us having perhaps between 50 and 100 personnel on site at every match day at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. We have we're the preferred suppliers of all the entertainment that takes place on a match day, and all of the premium hosts and hostesses that meet and greet people in the most important parts of the building. So when you walk in through the main doors, you're greeted by members of staff that we've designed a uniform for. We've put them in the uniforms, you know, we bring them in, we manage on the day. We have bands playing in different areas of the stadium. We have DJs, magicians, we've had face painters before. And all of this happens every single match day. And it's a huge operation. And of course, from that is, you know, you get a whole other spin-off of stuff going on. So that's really taken us in a completely different direction. And that all happens whilst I'm doing my magic, Craig's doing events, and Katrina's still dealing with her. You know, she books out performers for all different events as well. And that all still goes on as well.
That's amazing. That's incredible. Congratulations. I mean,
thank you.
Wonderful. That really
thank is. You. And And what's really interesting, exciting, I think, is that, you know, because this is a new venue and because now we're over this, at the moment, over this COVID thing, we've got the Anthony Joshua fight that's happening at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium in about 3 weeks' time. We've got the NFL matches that are taking place in October. There's two of those scheduled every single year, and they are huge. And then, you know, next year, I'm sure there'll be lots of music concerts, and it will be a venue very similar to Wembley Stadium or the O2. It will just be another one of those venues where you go and see the biggest names performing, because the stadium is magnificent and built for exactly that purpose.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Mm. I know I'm going to get this question in the comments, so I'm going to ask you. If somebody's watching this and they want to get on your radar, be they a balloon model or a face painter or a magician, is there a, and they live in and around your area and they think they're good enough, is there a way to get on your radar to be a part of your team? Or is it more of a case of like the A team, don't call us, we'll call you?
No, by all means, you can always drop your information. It's probably, yeah, if you drop the information to me, you can do that. The best email address actually to do that is nick@hattrickcreative.co.uk. And that will come through to me. And then, you know, it would be great to know who's out there, who's kind of nearby that has access to the stadium, and their skill sets. If they feel, you know, if the opportunity should arise, then we can get in touch.
That's wonderful. That's absolutely fantastic. I want to ask you two more questions, Nick, before we wrap this whole thing up. And the first question involves what is sitting behind you on that shelf. And I'm not talking about the Rubik's Cubes. I'm talking about all those wonderful awards for the Magic Circle. And you've entered and won close competitions. It's a question that comes up on this channel all the time. How do I win a competition? Should I enter a competition? You know, what's the reason for entering the competition? As somebody who's entered a lot of competitions and won and done a fantastic job, can we spend just a couple of minutes talking about any advice that you give somebody who wants to enter a competition? What was your reasonings for entering? And is there a secret sauce as to how you can actually win when you're going up against so many wonderful, you know, creators and performers?
Again, I call your attention to The Magic of Michael Amar, and there's a big essay in there about magic competitions I found incredibly helpful and motivating. So definitely check that out. I entered the Magic Circle close-up competition. I remember the first time I did it, it was at the Victory Services Club in London, very many years ago, way before we had the premises in Euston. And I remember Bobby Bernard being one of the judges, and I remember him snoring, fast asleep halfway through my act. And I thought, I'm not going to win this one. And I never did. But I had a decent act. It was all right. There were some nice moments. I wanted to do it as a challenge to myself. If you give yourself a deadline to come up with material, invariably you will, because there's a deadline and you haven't got a choice. And I think the same is true for many projects that I work on. I think as soon as someone gives it a date and says, you have to do this by this date, and that date's a month away, well, you know that in a month's time, you're going to be standing on a stage or in a room with people, and you're going to be expected to deliver. So you have to do something. So there's something inside that makes it happen. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's fear. I don't know whether it's creativity. I don't know whether it's stupidity. I'm not sure what it is, but it will get you to that finish line, because you have to be there by a certain time and date. So I use these very much as excuses to push myself to do something creative. The Magic Circle, I won the first one, I think, in 1996. Subsequently, I went to the Magic Castle and performed with David Penn. We went over there together, and we performed on a British week that they had there, which was a lot of fun. Gosh, that was an amazing experience. And then subsequently came back and I did win a second time. And then I went back for an all winners competition. And I won a third time as well for the all winners kind of Magic Circle centenary close-up magician, which was a great honor. Somewhere in the middle of all of that, James Friedman and a man who's no longer with us called John Wolvett, they had a company called Magic Management. And I became very good friends with them. When I used to go to the Magic Circle on a Monday night, we would sit and chat, have a lot of fun. over dinner. And one night they said to me, and I was only, I could only have been 19 at the time, 18 or 19. They said to me, we want to invest in you. And I went, what does that mean? And they went, we think you're really good. We want to send you to FISM. We're going to pay for you to go to FISM. And we want you to go and represent the UK, you know. And I said, well, what do you mean? And they said, well, we're going to pay for you to go to FISM and perform. And I was scared. I mean, I thought, well, why would someone do that? You know, why would two people that, albeit I know as friends, but not that well, I mean, they're much more experienced than me. I'm sure neither of them would be upset if I said that they were a generation slightly above me. I've got total respect for John, who's no longer with us, and still do for James Friedman, an amazing, amazing magician and very creative guy. And so when they said they wanted to pay for me, I was a bit freaked out by it, to be honest. No one had ever kind of said that to me before. But again, it gave me a reason to try and be as good as I could be, because I wasn't just going to let myself down. I was actually going to let them down. And they very kindly, you know, completely paid for me to go to FISM and perform. And I won joint second place, I think, with Sean Farquhar. Jason Latimer won, but I won joint second place at the World Magic Championships in 2003. So there you go. That's
I didn't
amazing.
Even know that, Nick. I thought I knew everything about your career. I didn't know that. That's incredible. Wow. How nerve-wracking that is.
It was nerve-wracking. I'll tell you, one of the things that made a huge difference, and I think perhaps why I did as well as I did, is because when I stepped out onto that stage, it was in a huge auditorium that probably seated 1,500 people, maybe more, and you're standing on a stage with a table expected to perform close-up magic. Well, if you're a close-up magician, and it goes back to what we were saying about the transition between close-up magic and performing on stage, if you're a close-up magician, you're very used to kind of head down, talking to this person, talking to that person. But because I was used to being on stage, I was very much head up and talking out and projecting and looking around and looking at the audience both up and down and to the left and the right. And so when I came out, even though I was doing a close-up gig, for me, it was like doing a cabaret gig. And I think I had that connection with the audience and that rapport, and that made them feel more at ease. And I believe that had, you know, just as much as the magic was important, I think your stage presence is just as important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree with you. It's the same when Blackpool had a close-up competition. You know, you walk out into that room and it's a close-up competition to like 1,000 people. It's not close-up. At that point, you need to kind of get that in your head. I remember competing at the Blackpool competition and thinking I'd done really well. And then John Vanderput came out and produced a dog. And I'm like, well, that's it, I'm done. There's me doing coin tricks and he's just made a dog appear. Like, I can't compete with that. So yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Nick, this has been incredible. I'm going to ask you one last question, which is, what's next? And what I mean by that is, like I said at the very beginning of this interview, you had a career that most people could only dream of. And everything that you've done, you've been successful, whether it's a lecturer, a creator, releasing products, performing, everything, you've been super successful. You've now got this second company, which is only going to grow post-COVID as Tottenham opens up and COVID goes away. It's only going to get busier. So what are your plans moving forward? Do you have anything left on your magical bucket list that you haven't yet hit? Do you want to carry on performing at the same level that you were before? Or are you eventually wanting to transition more into sort of a management role with this company? Is that going to take out more of your time? Are there other things that you're wanting to do that you haven't done yet?
Okay, so I think that from the Hattrick creative point of view, I think things will invariably get busier. We have other clients and we're working on other things, and that's kind of just growing on its own. So I think there will be a time when that gets, you know, quite busy. So that's exciting, little project. I say little, and it's a quite a big project, takes up a lot of time. But my first love is still performing. I think that I would like to be performing almost exclusively stand-up and be doing close up as and when I want to, rather than because I, you know, need to. I love performing stand up stuff, so I want to develop some more material, work on some of the stuff that I'm doing to make it better than it is. And I think performing will always be my first love, but just growing everything around me. And I've never really been one of these people. I do get asked a lot, and a lot of people ask the question, where do you see yourself in 5 years or 10 years time? What's your long-term plan? I've never had a long-term plan because for me, I like to take each day as it comes. You never quite know what email is going to come in or what phone call. And it happens to every single person. I know it would happen to you, Craig. You know, you get a call or an email from someone and it sparks something completely new that you never even thought was going to happen. And suddenly you're heading down that road when you thought you were going down that road. And that can happen at any time to any one of us. And so, yeah, I don't think too far ahead. I quite like just kind of doing what I'm doing and seeing where the road takes me. And hopefully it will continue to grow and I'll continue to perform.
And are you still going to be releasing products in the future? Is that still something that's in your head? Because I think the last thing that you released was the money deck through PropDog, possibly.
I mean, that was a PropDog release. So I actually spoke to PropDog and said that this is an idea that I haven't really done anything with. Do you want to take the ball and run with it? And they absolutely did. Yeah, it's a really nice little, that was in my FISM routine, actually, the money deck.
That is how I opened up my my virtual shows when I was doing virtual shows.
Oh, really?
With an overhead cam, lovely.
Beautiful.
Boom, and then they're there and going into Matrix. I couldn't find a better opener. It was amazing.
Yeah, that's a really lovely, smart idea actually for virtual shows. That's great. I think the last product that I put out was probably DFB. I'm trying to think if there was anything more recent than that. But that's been the big thing. I've got a couple of things bubbling away in the back of my head that I would like to try and do something with, but as and when that happens, it will. And I definitely will release something else at some point in the future. Mm-hmm. So watch this space.
Perfect. Now, people that are watching this, how can they keep in touch with you? Do you have, I'm going to put some links at the bottom. You mentioned your email address. Do you have social media links? And is there a store where we can buy your things from, Nick, and get onto a mailing list where...
Thank you. I'm pretty poor with social media stuff. So you probably won't find me on Twitter or Instagram, or you probably will, but I won't find you because I don't even know my login details. So... It's pretty useless. However, you can if you go to einhorn.co.uk, which is my website, einhorn.co.uk, and you click on the shop, all my products that are available from there. I don't have huge amounts of stock, so sometimes you're better off going to your favorite magic store and buying the product from there, because a lot of it I don't hold stock here necessarily. It gets kept in America and shipped out as and when people want it. That's the shop. If you want to get in touch with me, you can do so through that website, einhorn.co.uk. My email address is info@einhorn.co.uk for anything magic related.
Perfect. And I mentioned on this channel earlier on, a few weeks ago, somebody asked the question, what's the best coin in bottle ever? And I said, unicorn coin in bottle. Without a shadow of a doubt, it makes it so much easier. Is that available? Because I had a lot of people trying.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it is.
On the site, yeah.
It is, but it doesn't, you know, the thing with that is that you still need to buy the coin. Okay. It doesn't come with the coin. So that's just a heads up for anyone that buys that. So you have to have the right type of coin for it, which I don't sell. But yes, the corks are available.
Perfect. Nick, this has been an incredible interview. Thank you so much. I was super excited when we found time to get our calendars to mesh to be able to do this. And you haven't disappointed. You are a huge inspiration. You really are. You've achieved so much in magic. So many people look up to you. And I just want to congratulate you on all the success you've had and continue to have, and I'm sure will have in the future. Thank you so much for coming on the channel.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure. And thank you for your good wishes. It's great to be part of your project here. And it's been great. So thank you for enjoyed it immensely.
Thanks, Nick. Guys, do me a favor. Leave a comment down below. Nick's not great on social media. He might not read it, but I'll send them over to him. So there you go. Leave a comment down below. Let me know what you think. And don't forget, you want to see more videos like this? Subscribe to the channel, leave a comment, and I will be back again tomorrow with another video. I'll see you then. Thanks very much for watching.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic, magic.
Be
magic.
Sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.